Welcome to MetaStrategy's Forum on World-Class IT. I'm Peter Hai, and I'm pleased to welcome Gene Kim to the broadcast. Gene is an entrepreneur and author focused on IT operations, information security, and DevOps. Gene co-founded the software company Tripwire, a security and compliance software company that was acquired by Belden, a manufacturer of networking and cable products. During his time at Tripwire, Gene began his passion of studying high-performing IT organizations, eventually codifying his observations of good to great IT transformations into two books, The Visible Ops Handbook and Visible Ops Security. In 2010, Gene departed his CTO position at Tripwire to start the next chapter in his life. This eventually led to several books, including Gene's upcoming book, The DevOps Cookbook, and The Phoenix Project, a novel about IT, DevOps, and helping your business win, the latter reaching number one under Amazon's business management subcategory. Gene also co-founded the IT Process Institute, an organization committed to improving the operating performance of IT organizations across industries. He has been voted an up-and-coming IT individual by publications including InfoWorld and Computer World, and was given the Outstanding Alumnus Award in 2009 by Purdue University's Department of Computer Sciences. I recently caught up with Gene by phone from his home in Portland, Oregon, and our conversation covered World-Class IT Principle 2, Infrastructure, and Principle 3, Project and Portfolio Management, as we discussed the concepts of DevOps, its transferability across a wide variety of industries and organizations, characteristics of the most impactful leaders of DevOps, and themes from Gene's upcoming book, The DevOps Cookbook, among other topics. This is Peter Hai. Please consider reading my new book, Implementing World-Class IT Strategy, How IT Can Drive Organizational Innovation. The book covers topics such as the CIO as strategic facilitator, the development of IT missions, facilitating corporate and divisional strategy, the development of IT's own strategic plans, the development of enterprise architecture, reviewing, refreshing, and communicating strategy, and a variety of other topics. You can find it at Amazon.com, my publisher's website, Wiley.com, and at your better bookstores. Thank you very much. Well, Gene Kim, welcome to the Forum on World-Class IT.
Oh, great to be here, Peter. Thank you.
No, it's a pleasure to have you. I thought we'd begin with a very sort of obvious and broad question, and that is, what is DevOps? I know from a lot of my conversations with chief information officers that it's a topic that many of them are thinking about. Some have, in fact, gone whole hog and made the appropriate changes to explore DevOps within their organizations, while others might only have heard the term without really understanding what it means. And so I thought I'd go to the source of the idea and understand from you, what is DevOps exactly?
You know, I've been studying high-performing technology organizations since 1999. And I think the reason why everyone is so interested in DevOps is that it solves a problem that we've all experienced in our careers, which is how do we simultaneously enable the fast flow of features from delivery through test and running into operations while preserving world-class reliability, stability, and security. For most of us, you know, I think this is something that we felt were mutually opposed. You can either get fast flow or you can get great reliability. And so what DevOps really represents to me are the cultural norms and the technical practices that enable us to finally get both. And we know that organizations can do this because organizations like Amazon, Google, Twitter, Etsy, Netflix, and increasingly organizations like Disney, GE, you know, Target, and Nordstrom, you know, they're able to replicate this where we can get incredibly high rates of flow from dev to ops as measured by high levels, high frequency of deployments and short lead times, while also preserving great reliability. So that means high change success rates, low mean time repair. And so we phrase it like this because, you know, it is partially cultural. It's also partly based in technical practices of how we can do this. And so my area of passion right now is really codifying what are those necessary steps required to get from here to there.
Great topic for us to explore a little bit further. How does one get from here to there? What are some of the people changes, for instance, or process changes that an organization ought to think about in order to begin to explore DevOps more fully?
No, exactly, right? Part of it is cultural, and part of it is incentive structures between dev, test, and operations. Mm-hmm. And then part of it are, you know, more than just agile, really the technical practices like continuous integration, continuous test, continuous delivery, continuous deployment. These are all the preconditions of what is required, you know, to get from one pouring months or even quarters to get from development through the test cycle, through the deployment cycle, and through operations. How do you compress that so that we can go from months to ideally minutes, which is what, you know, high performers do these days?
And then from a staffing perspective, do you find that the companies that you work with and have been exposed to as a result of the phenomenon that is the Phoenix Project and the all that you have sort of brought to bear relative to the topic, are there different kinds of people that organizations ought to recruit in order to be best suited for this? Do you find that there's a new set of skills that's necessary within organizations in order to achieve this?
Yeah, I think there are certain characteristics that we see in every one of these high performers, whether it's a an organization like a unicorn, like an Amazon, a Netflix, Spotify, or a horse, whether, you know, Nordstrom that targets the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, these organizations that are actually replicating these unicorn-like outcomes. And in the Phoenix Project, we framed it in the three ways, which are intended to be the set of principles from which you can derive all of the observed DevOps patterns from. And so the first way is all about, you know, accelerating flow as you go from left to right in the value stream, from dev to ops. The second way is the way of flow, the way of feedback. You know, how do you create effective feedback from ops back into dev so that when something bad goes wrong, whether it's a service impairment, service down, a security breach, how do we prevent that bad thing from happening again, or if we can't prevent it, enable quicker detection and recovery? And then the third way is all about creating this culture of continual learning and experimentation using the notions of high trust culture, where, you know, the most competitive organizations are the ones that can learn, that can turn local improvements into global improvements. Mm. Broadly speaking, it means that we need managers and practitioners who can work not just in their dev silo or test silo or operations silo or information security, but how do we create the boundary spanners so that, you know, instead of optimizing for just our area of responsibility, we're actually optimizing for the entire value stream. And, you know, the goal really is fast flow from idea, you know, to actually running in production, you know, fast feedback so that, you know, when something goes wrong, it's not just dev throwing it over the wall to ops, it's ops helping get dev ready to ship features in a way that doesn't cause chaos and disruption downstream. That actually sets the stage for things like, you know, doing A-B testing and creating organizational learning, not just through dev, test, and operations, but through the entire business value stream. And ultimately, I think that's how we win in the marketplace. There's a growing school of thought that says, in order to win in the marketplace requires us to out-experiment the competition. And I think that's what the whole game is all about, you know, create a learning organization that has been discussed in the literature for decades, but has never been more relevant than in IT and specifically DevOps.
You mentioned some of the companies that are using this, and they're sort of the usual suspects of the Googles and Netflixes, Amazons of the world, as you mentioned, but it's also now expanding into large and much older and staid organizations, including the U.S. government, as you pointed out. Yeah. And so is the common denominator of what you've found in terms of organizations that have been able to leverage DevOps, is there a common denominator, size or scale or speed? It certainly sounds like it goes across industries, but are there certain kinds of companies that are best suited for this?
Oh, what a great question. You know, so I think that question is what set us out to run the DevOps Enterprise Summit back in October. And the goal was to not have the unicorns present, but the horses, right? Because what we were interested in is how are large, complex organizations that have been around for decades or maybe even centuries, how are they adapting DevOps patterns, and how are they replicating the outcomes that we've seen in the unicorns? And the stories that were told were just, in my mind, breathtaking. It was organizations like Disney, GE Capital, Nationwide Insurance, you know, the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, you know, all these organizations that have the legacy of success, right? You know, they've had decades of market success and economic success, yet they're all realizing that in order for them to win in the marketplace requires them to focus not on controlling cost, but really optimizing for speed. I would say that the patterns, there were three takeaways for me, was that the patterns and principles are very much the same, but the level of savviness and sophistication required to actually mobilize this kind of subversive and innovative effort like DevOps, which can be so disruptive, is breathtaking. You know, that essentially it takes a courageous leader to mobilize the organization and often have to take on, you know, the naysayers in dev, test, operations, and information security, the product owners. And essentially, you know, it takes a very special person to drive a transformation like that, where they're essentially having to almost take on the entire organization and the organizational bureaucracy to make it so. And yet, you know, I think there were the paths painted had a lot of similarities, often driven by architecture. It was often driven by a director of operations, and you know, in some cases, it was driven by a director of development. So it just says that some of these leaders will show up in the most surprising of places. Essentially, they verbalized three problems that I thought were interesting. I asked every speaker, there were 50 speakers, I asked all of them to end with a slide that said, here's what I'm looking for help on, or here's what I don't know how to do. And the three themes that showed up the most often were, one, in order for us to get from here to there, we need to have automated testing. And yet, how do we do that for legacy apps that have been around for decades? So that, you know, that's a can that we've kicked down the road for, you know, decades, is how do we do real automated testing? Secondly is, we want to make DevOps so, but security and compliance won't let us. So we're seeing some patterns on how to overcome those obstacles. And the third one was, we want to make it so everywhere, but how do we get upper management to allow us to, you know, mash the pedal to the floor? And so I'll say those three things are, you know, I think what really represents kind of the grandest challenges in terms of accelerating DevOps transformations in large, complex organizations.
Yeah, that makes sense. There's a lot of cheese that's being moved around, so to speak, as this suggests some differences in terms of responsibilities and pulling together what had previously been separate. You know, it strikes me as I hear you talking, Gene, that this goes along with a variety of other factors that have emerged within IT departments, within enterprises more generally speaking, like virtualization of technology, leveraging cloud computing, more creatively establishing ecosystems of partners, all of which are designed ultimately to, you know, variabilize the cost structure, set up the organization for speed. And this seems like, just as you point out, another one of those themes that is, if leveraged appropriately, can ensure that the organization becomes more of an idea factory, more of a innovation engine than perhaps could have been the case when there were entrenched infrastructure with tremendous fixed cost and a huge percentage of people who were basically looking backwards, that is, looking after past decisions, as opposed to thinking about the future, the realm of innovation, so to speak. And so I just wonder, you know, it seems like in some ways this is a particularly good time because of the confluence of factors from a technology perspective, from a process perspective, even from a people perspective, that seem to be shifting more towards an understanding of this need for speed. I'd love your reaction to that, if you would.
Oh, I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, I don't say this lightly. I think we are living in a time of miracles. I mean, there are things that are becoming commonplace that were just not possible 5 years ago. In fact, the notion of doing tens or hundreds, let alone, you know, thousands of deployments per day, was something that we would have thought, if not impossible, probably immoral or, you know, hopelessly reckless, you know, even 5 years ago. And yet those are things that are now able to happen. I mean, this whole notion of, you know, in order to get fast flow, you know, what we need to do is create feedbacks as quickly and cheaply and, you know, as rampantly as possible. And, you know, things like container, virtualization, cloud. I mean, this makes certain things that were impossible 5 years ago very much possible. I think one of the best examples is, you know, containers. It used to be the fact that, you know, developers would be responsible for maybe at best writing unit tests and checking that in. These days, it's now considered increasingly commonplace that every developer have an entire integration test environment running in containers, running on their laptop. So not only is the developer required to write unit tests, but they will write and perform integration testing on their laptop. That's something that used to take, you know, at best, you know, hours, probably more likely days or weeks to be able to do in the old days. And so, you know, I think this dramatically changes, you know, roles and responsibilities. And what it boils down to is, it so dramatically increases developer productivity and our ability to innovate and test ideas in the marketplace. So I think it's almost as if we finally figured out what technology is for, very recently.
That's so interesting. I wonder if you could just take a quick moment, as containers seem to be coming up more and more in my conversation with tech executives, as a real phenomenon that is going to be kind of one of the next leaps forward, so to speak, for a lot of organizations. Can you take a moment just to kind of give an overview of the whole concept of containers?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, I mean, I think the best way is to give a concrete example that really caused my jaw to hit the floor. This story came from Elizabeth Sullivan. She helped pioneer the concepts of automated testing 10 years ago. She's now the director of quality engineering at Pivotal Labs for the Cloud Foundry project. And she described how one of the biggest problems when she joined, this was 2.5 years ago, was that it would take developers, for any change that they would put into production, it would take them about 30 minutes to 2 hours to have to deploy those changes to, say, 30 to 40 virtual machines in the integration test environment. And they said, her conclusion was that was far too long. Right? In other words, developers, if they have to wait 4 hours to see whether their change was good or bad, it basically means that you're not going to find out until the big production deployment where it blows up in front of the customer. So their countermeasure was to basically take that entire integration test environment that's very complex and get them all running so they can all run in containers on the dev laptops. And so that when a developer makes a change, they can now spin up an entire new surface area of an integration test environment in less than 5 minutes. And by doing that, by giving developers fast feedback on the work, it dramatically increased the quality of their work, as well as the customer outcomes. And so I think it means that it eases deployment. Yes, it's like a lightweight virtualization or so forth. But the way we can use it means that we can now fix issues on developers, part of their daily work, as opposed to production operations discovering it, when they deploy code and make it visible to the customer.
Gene, I know you're working on your next book right now. In fact, I believe it's nearing its conclusion, if I've got the time horizon correct. Can you talk a bit about some of the concepts you're putting together in your next book?
Yeah, so the Phoenix Project, we put that book out almost 2 years ago now, in January of 2013. And that's been the most fun adventure I've ever been on. And that was really put in the form of a novel, just like many of us when we read the book The Goal by Dr. Goldratt, about a novel about plant management. I think it caused many of us to have an aha moment. Our goal was really to see if we could replicate those aha moments and do that for the current generation of technology management. And so the DevOps cookbook, or maybe called the DevOps handbook, is really meant to be the nonfiction companion guide that really describes in detail how did the management team at Parts Unlimited in the Phoenix Project, achieve their transformation. Break it down into steps from a planning and organizational perspective to, say 4 or 5 projects it took to reduce lead times, increase deployment frequencies, reduce mean time to repair, and increase change success rates. And that's really based on studying how high performers have worked, as well as the learnings we've had benchmarking over 14,000 organizations, really trying to understand what specific cultural norms and technical practices enable high performance.
I was curious, how did you elect to go about it in novel form? Were you inspired, in fact, by other books like you've mentioned that were written in such a form? Was it the ability to kind of talk about the good and the bad of Bill, the IT manager at Parts Unlimited, without having to kind of tell sort of challenging stories of people who were the real people necessarily? How did it occur to you? Was it sort of the most entertaining way to write the story?
Yeah, when I read the goal, I mean, it just changed my life. I mean, that was probably 18 years ago. And I remember reading that book. And even though I had no experience in plant management or ever worked in a plant, I mean, there was just no doubt in my mind that the lessons being imparted in that book were relevant to the way that we work in IT. And so I think the surface area of the problem that DevOps solves, it goes against some of our biggest preconceived notions, whether we are in development, whether in test or in operations. And I think the form of a novel is actually very well suited for that, just to show that there is a common journey that we have, and that so many of the problems that we see in our decade plus long careers can be reflected in how dev test and operations work together or don't work together. And so I think by spending half of the book portraying those problems to a fictitious company, I think gave us the right to be able to prescribe what the solution is. I think only once we can show that we understand the problem, you know, do we really earn the right to talk about the solution. So yeah, I'm hoping that, you know, other people will have the same sort of aha moments that reading the Phoenix Project that, you know, a bunch of us had when we read The Goal.
And you were a co-founder of Tripwire, the CTO of the organization for roughly 13 years, again, if I've got the dates correct. How did you decide to go from entrepreneur, successful entrepreneur of a great company, to writing and researching as a primary occupation? How was that was that always by design? Was it something that appealed to you as you got further along in your career?
You know, one of the my journey at Tripwire was one of the most rewarding and intellectually satisfying points of my career. And I think one of the key parts of that was being in a position where I could study these high-performing technology organizations. And so that journey started for me in 1999. And by the time 2006 rolled around, it became a study not just of how operations and security working together. It was really emerging that it wasn't, you know, it was achieving the achievement of all IT goals. So that involves dev, test, operations, and information security. And so that's really been the passion for me for the vast majority of my professional career. And, you know, to be able to spend the most of my time understanding what high performance looks like and be able to research how do organizations get from here to there. I've never been having as much fun as right now.
That's wonderful. Well, Gene Kim, thank you so much for joining us on the Forum on World Class IT and sharing some perspectives on DevOps, on your career path, and all that you're working on. It's been a great conversation.
Oh, thank you so much. And if anyone is interested in looking at an early revision of the DevOps cookbook, you know, please let me know, and I'll send out the information. I'll send out ways to reach me, and I would love everyone's candid scrutiny and feedback.
Perfect. We'll include a link so that anyone who's listening can find that and be in touch with Gene should you wish to.
Peter, thank you so much.
You've just listened to a podcast in a series we call MetaStrategy's Forum on World Class IT. If you like what you've heard, please consider reading my book, World Class IT, Why Businesses Succeed When IT Triumphs, published by Josie Bass, a division of Wiley Press, in December of 2009. Both the book and the Forum on World Class IT offer stories from a wide range of top IT leaders relating to MetaStrategy's five principles of World Class IT. The five principles are as follows. Principle one is people, and it's really the foundational principle. Without the right people doing the right jobs at the right time, it'll be nearly impossible to achieve excellent performance. The second principle is infrastructure. We like to say that this is the principle that separates proactive organizations from reactive ones. If infrastructure is not reliably performing its tasks, the IT organization will become stuck in reactive mode, consistently fighting fires. If systems and hardware and networks and so on work reliably, then a larger portion of the organization can think about the future. The third principle is project and portfolio management. This is the engine through which new capabilities can be brought to bear on behalf of the company. It is important to ensure that projects are delivered on time, on budget, and on target, and that the portfolio collectively supports the objectives of the business. The fourth principle is IT and business partnerships. It's important that, first and foremost, the different parts of IT, from business analysis to development and QA, through to support and all other aspects of IT, communicate effectively and efficiently. It's equally important, then, that IT develop a partnering relationship with the business that it is a part of. If the three prior principles are done well, then IT should earn a place at the strategy setting table, driving different parts of the business strategy. The fifth and last principle is external partnerships. Outsourcing is becoming a crucial weapon that organizations are employing, and managing these relationships to ensure that value is achieved is critical. In the fourth principle, the organization has learned and contributed to the discussion about what is strategic and what is not. Once that's clear, then it will be easier to determine which aspects of IT might be better managed by external partners or vendors. For more information on these five principles and the sub-principles that are associated with each, please visit our website at www.metastrategy.com, and please share your thoughts and comments by contacting us at feedback@metastrategy.com. And our theme music was written by David Armin. I'm Peter High. Thanks for listening.